Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president goes to Michigan. Newt Gingrich wants to go to the moon. Yeah, just another day in the American economy, everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 27th of January. Good to have you with us. President Obama wrapped up his State of the Union roadshow today in Michigan. Education was the policy prescription du jour. And as he mentioned in his speech on Tuesday, the president wants to overhaul federal funding of higher education and in the process make college more affordable for more people. So he's going to go with the carrot and stick. More federal dollars for schools that do well at holding down tuition costs, less for those who don't, and more money for certain key programs, including one that helped to get a lot of people through school. Work Study. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has the story.
Work Study works like this. A student applies for financial aid. The very neediest students get something extra, a job, usually at minimum wage, for about 10 hours a week. For freshman Jesse Newman, that means hitting the gym at George Washington University in downtown D.C. She re-racks weights and checks out equipment.
I use the money from the gym as like my spending money instead of using my savings account as my spending money, so I save more.
That means Newman doesn't have to rack up more student loans to pay for tuition, room, and board, which is north of $50,000 a year at GW. Almost a million students got work-study jobs last year, according to the American Council on Education. They earned an average of $1,500. President Obama wants to double the number of jobs.
For some of our students, it's absolutely vital for their ability to get through school.
That's Bethena Shukri. She works at GW's Career Center, helping work-study students find jobs in the library or lab. About three-quarters of the money for the program comes from the federal government. Schools pony up the rest. Terry Hartle is a senior vice president at the American Council on Education. He says both political parties want to bring down the cost of college.
And one can imagine that both parties might like to do something about it in an election year.
President Obama will need congressional approval for his proposed reforms, but with the poisonous atmosphere on Capitol Hill these days, Hartle doesn't expect much action this year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The Republican presidential candidates talked about a whole lot of things in their debate last night. Immigration, health care, and for a good 10 or 12 minutes or so, whether or not we ought to build a permanent colony on the moon. Newt Gingrich wants NASA to offer prizes to encourage private businesses to invest in a lunar colony. So for more on the big costs and possible benefits, we turned to Marketplace's Bob Moon.
If this idea sounds vaguely familiar, it is. In 2004, then-President George W. Bush laid out a $100 billion proposal for a permanent moon base. It would be a launching pad to what he called worlds beyond our own.
As our knowledge improves, we'll develop new power generation, propulsion, life support, and other systems that can support more distant travels.
Supporters said those advances in technology could lead to new sources of energy and other benefits back on Earth. Technological spin-offs have long been used to justify spending on space. Leroy Chow is a former space station commander.
The neat thing about a space program is you don't know what technical spin-offs will come out of it. But, you know, in the Apollo program, even the most conservative estimates show that it returned 2 to 1, you know, per dollar spent on spin-offs and making life better on the Earth.
The first moon program brought us everything from Teflon and polarized sunglasses to the thermal foil we use to wrap frozen food. At last night's debate, Senator Rick Santorum pointed out another potential benefit, inspiration.
We need to inspire. One of the big problems we have in our country today is that young people are not getting involved in math and science and not dreaming big dreams.
Problem is, the Bush idea never really inspired the nation, or more importantly, budget makers. President Obama killed the moon colony plan soon after taking office amid tightening budgets. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
From moon colonies to cars now. People who are in the market for a new car usually offer up a fairly standard list of particulars. They want reliability and good mileage and high satisfaction ratings, they say. I got news for you. A new study suggests a good number of you are lying. That's all you can call it. And that you decide largely on looks and feel. Marketplace's Scott Tong can relate.
The spouse in my house has minivan prejudice. She's a soccer mom, but she said she refuses to look like one. Negative car perceptions are strong. I found out today at the Washington Auto Show.
We have our six-way power seats with lumbar adjustments.
The salespersons talk of vehicle pluses, but car shopper Eric Strass has brand minuses in his mind.
I would be very, perhaps, reluctant to buy some brands. You might have to convince me that it's worth buying that brand.
He didn't say which brand, nor did this man, who gave his name simply as Marty. Does he diss any brands?
There are a few. But for the most part, I love cars, so I just come here and I'm just like kid in a candy store when I come here.
J.D. Power's John Osborne says in the new survey, 43% of car buyers avoid a particular model, not because of data, but because of, ew.
And most people said, well, you know what, that's just what generally people know about that knowledge. It's general hearsay, or it's tribal knowledge, if you will.
Which brands need to turn around the tribal chatter? Osborne says Jaguar and Lincoln have reputations for being unreliable.
Yet their reliability scores are actually very good. They're in the top 5 brands.
Now to remake that minivan image at home. We shall overcome. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I used to own a Jag, an old one. Never, ever worked, man. On Wall Street today, another split decision to end the week. GDP growth came in a hair lower than expectations. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is about the moment on a Friday when we pause to figure out exactly what happened in the past 5 days and what it all means. Gross domestic product, the Federal Reserve saying the economy is still eh. It's a little thing we like to call our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine with us, also Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal, and a mystery guest to be named later. Lee, Sudeep, hey guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Lee, this week it's been the Federal Reserve with low interest rates from now till kingdom come, and the GDP report this morning, which was not so bad but not great. Where are we? What kind of week has it been?
Well, the mood has been not so great. I mean, I think people are expecting a strong recovery well before kingdom come, and that's clearly not happening. And in a way, you know, people are forgetting that we've been through a whole lot of superlatives. You know, we went through the worst crisis, and real estate prices dropped more than they did during the Depression. So the notion that we're going to have a super strong recovery anytime about now is kind of like, you know, it's a little bit unfounded.
Sudeep, I heard a guy say this morning, you know, it's going to be an L-shaped recovery. And I thought about that for a second, and I'm like, wait, what kind of recovery is L-shaped? That's just kind of status quo, man.
L-shaped is what everyone's been talking about for a while. Everyone was hoping for a V-shaped recovery before. Now we're just going to have, a disappointing recovery. We're 4 years from the point of the recession starting, and now the Fed's telling us we've got at least three more years of this extraordinary action. The really worrying thing now is that everything seems to look a little better on the surface. GDP numbers look good on the surface, but under the surface, there are all sorts of problems there. Jobs numbers look better on the surface, but we've got this huge problem in the labor market.
Yeah.
And even if you look abroad, the international waters look a lot calmer today, but there are so many deep, deep problems beneath it that are just ready to jump up and destroy us again.
Well, that is what you call a perfect segue. We are going international right now. Felix Salmon from Reuters is the mystery guest today. He's at the World Economic Forum up in Davos, Switzerland. Hey, Felix.
Hi, Kai.
So I would ask you what the mood is, but really I don't care what the mood is over there, right? What I want to know is, what are people talking about that's not all about themselves over there? Are they talking about the United States and our problems? Are they talking about the Greeks? I mean, what are people actually talking about?
Oh, no one cares about the United States. And for the first time, that I can remember, no one even cares about China. The only thing that anybody cares about is Europe. They're obsessed with whether the European Union is going to stay together, whether countries are going to leave the euro, about where the money is going to come from to keep the union together, whether any solutions are going to be found, or whether it's all going to go very, very horribly pear-shaped.
Pear-shaped? What does that mean?
Wrong.
Oh,
bad.
Right. Is that because most people in there are from Europe? I mean, there are a lot of Americans, but, you know, it's fairly Eurocentric.
It is Eurocentric, and one of the weird things about the forum is that historically it was a bunch of rich Europeans who felt on top of the world, both metaphorically and in Davos, literally, and sort of sitting up here on top of an Alp, solving the world's problems.
One Alp, right? You're on top of an Alp?
We're on top of an Alp, and we're solving the world's problems, and we are rich, and the rest of the world isn't as rich as us, and we can help the world be as rich as we are. And now, of course, it's Europe which is in crisis, and the rest of the world sort of looking at Europe and saying, haha, you know what, we're not actually going to help you very much. You're going to have to work this out on your own. And Europe going, we don't think we can do that.
Yeah. So, Lee, we had Greece was a topic of conversation last week because we thought a deal was done. And now we think, again, there's a deal done. Where are we going to eventually find some kind of solution to this?
I don't know. I mean, the more this crisis goes on, I think there's a feeling here that, maybe the U.S. can escape this whole Europe mess without anything.
That just seems dangerous to think, don't you think?
It does seem dangerous, yeah. But and maybe this is a sign of the times, but we are starting to see it come out in earnings releases as, you know, one of a couple excuses for results being less than normal, which you never quite know. It's kind of like the weather and retailers. You never know if it really impacts. But, you know, I think it's just continued to be long and drawn out. I mean, it's with every... I think we're used to these news events coming and going with Europe. So we've sounded some more alarms, though, from the IMF with Greece this week. Yeah. So that may heat up soon. Yeah.
Sudeep, is there any sense in Washington? I mean, that idea that Lee had of, you know, maybe we can get away and dodge this bullet. Is that what they're thinking in Washington, crossing their fingers and hoping to die?
There are a lot of people crossing their fingers and hoping to live at least for the next 40 weeks through the election. Yeah. And that's one of the big worrying things right now is this moment feels a lot like the spring and summer of 2008, right before the deepest of the financial crisis hit, where things started to look better because of policy actions, where we might have been at the point of hope, and it quickly turned around. Because if you look at what's happening in Greece, they have so many issues under the surface that are about to come out. Everyone knows, it's no longer a secret that the results there, whatever happens, it's just going to be a Band-Aid, and we're going to be playing the same, dealing with the same problem 3 months down the road. And even with the U.S. economy, everything is so fragile that there's this great degree of nervousness, at least among people in charge.
I don't like it on a Friday when you guys start talking about 2008. Sudeep Reddy with the Wall Street Journal in Washington. Lee Gallagher with Fortune Magazine. She's in New York. And Felix Salmon of Reuters. He's at Davos at the World Economic Forum. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
I'm
gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Letters starts today with a clip from Newt Gingrich. This is from last night's Republican debate.
It will be an American campaign open to every American who prefers a paycheck to food stamps, who prefers the Declaration of Independence to Saul Alinsky, and who prefers a strong national security to trying to appease our enemies.
Senator
Saul Alinsky. Well-known community organizer of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, noted figure of the American left, and a frequent source of comparison in this campaign, not just by Mr. Gingrich either. Our interview Monday about Mr. Alinsky drew some letters, including this one from Robert Swanson of Pine Mountain, Georgia.
Any story about Alinsky that doesn't even mention his book, Rules for Radicals, describes him as quite a conservative guy and omits how his methods have been used extensively by the Occupy movement, isn't up to marketplace standards.
We had Charles Duhigg from the New York Times on the program yesterday, talking about the poor working conditions in factories that supply parts for Apple and how, if anything's going to change, consumers have to adjust their expectations away from a perfect new iPhone every 6 months. Leslie Dickinson wrote in from Mount Airy, Maryland.
Is it the chicken or the egg? Are Apple and the news media creating this consumer demand or just responding to it? If the product is so wonderful and innovative, won't consumers be willing to wait for it?
Last but not least, the little old lady from Pasadena. In a story this week, we said it was a Beach Boys song. Not true, though, they did do a cover version.
It's the little old lady from Pasadena.
It was actually a Jan and Dean original, 1964. Here you go.
It's the little old lady from Pasadena.
As always, drop us a line. Let us know what you think. Marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up.
Getting robbed of a bicycle is so personal and it just burns people up.
Happened to me when I was a kid. The underground bike economy. But first, let's do the numbers. The theme today on Wall Street was expectations dashed. The Dow Industrials lost 74 points, about a half percent, finished at 12,660. The NASDAQ gained 11 points, 0.4%, closed at 2816. The S&P 500 trimmed 2 points, 0.1%, settled at 1,316. For the week, the Dow Industrials gave back nearly a half percent. The NASDAQ up 1%. The S&P 500 basically flat, inched up less than a tenth of 1%. Chevron drained 2% today. The energy company reported quarterly earnings below what analysts projected. ExxonMobil down 1%. Procter & Gamble washed away 0.7%. The company behind Tide cut its earnings outlook for the year. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.89%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for December. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano delivers the second annual State of America's Homeland Security Address. And grab your Stetson. The National Cowboy Poetry Gathering gets underway in Elko, Nevada. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. This has been another day of protests and demonstrations in Cairo and across much of Egypt as well, marking the first anniversary of the revolution that drove Hosni Mubarak from office. Despite a glimmer of democracy in the past year, a lot of the economic problems back then are still around. Corruption, poverty, and especially unemployment. Unemployment for young people. The unemployment rate for Egyptians under the age of 30 is 35%. From Cairo, Marketplace's Stephen Beard wraps up our series, One Year On.
Iyad Dawood is a rarity. He's one of the few young Egyptians to benefit economically from the revolution. He's just got a job in a business that's taking off. In a TV control room, the director launches the latest edition of a news show aimed at Egyptian youth. It's presented by Iyad. This station is one of a dozen private channels that have sprung up since the revolution.
People now are more thirsty for information, different kinds of information, and they're not only depending on one source. I can't think of any other field that had this kind of expansion other than the media.
Iyad lost his old job as a TV reporter in the dying days of the Mubarak regime. He was out of work for a year. He spent the time campaigning for democracy in Tahrir Square. His new bosses clearly believe this gives him credibility in the new Egypt.
Now you can say whatever you want to say. I mean, this is one of the few benefits that we did take from the revolution. I mean, we still have a long way to go. On the other hand, one of the things we got is the freedom to speak.
Just how free the new TV stations will be is not yet clear. Iyad says if he's censored, he'll quit. But for now, he's greatly relieved to be back at work.
Now I know that by the beginning of next month, I'll get paid and I'll give back my mother what I owe her. And of course, it feels great now that I can be responsible for myself again and do what I love.
Iyad's glamorous new job seems a world away from Hadia Hassan's humdrum existence. 20-year-old Hadar stands over a battered old washing machine doing the laundry. She lives with her parents, her brother and sister, in a cement block apartment building on a muddy road in North Cairo. The household depends solely on her father's meagre income as a cab driver. Hadia graduated from high school last summer and she's still unemployed.
Every day I wake up, I eat breakfast, I study, I watch TV or I sleep. Only that, I don't do anything else.
Hadia says she's looked for a job but without much hope of finding one.
Most of us are educated and we don't have work. My cousin has a degree in business and he's driving a rickshaw. He should be working in a bank. There are no jobs, there are no opportunities for work.
And Hadir doesn't seem to feel the revolution will make much difference.
Last year, when the revolution happened, I was finishing school. I knew that even if I looked for a job, I won't find one. I am sure of it, now or even in the future.
So far, the revolution has generated employment for a privileged few, people like TV presenter Iyad Dawood. To succeed, it will need to create jobs for 800,000 school and college leavers a year, people like Hadir Hassan. In Cairo, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's a cliché because it's true. As Egypt goes, so goes the Middle East.
Commentator Reza Aslan.
The most populous Arab country in the world has long been a bellwether for the region as a whole. and the outcome of Egypt's journey from dictatorship to democracy will undoubtedly set the tone for the new Middle East. So then, 1 year after the revolution, how's Egyptian democracy coming along? Not very well, I'm afraid. Despite historic elections and a newly seated parliament, the military has maintained its iron grip over the people. Pro-democracy NGOs have been shut down, journalists have been detained, there have been beatings and mass arrests on the streets, torture and virginity tests in the prisons. You can forgive the average Egyptian for thinking the country has replaced one dictatorship with another, except now the economy is worse. And yet, President Obama's State of the Union speech did not mention Egypt once. No praising the Egyptian people or demanding the military return to the barracks. No threat to cut military funding unless soldiers stop shooting protesters. Nothing at all. This despite the fact that he was speaking on the one-year anniversary of the Egyptian revolution. We have to understand that whether we like it or not, America's fate is intimately tied to that of Egypt. If Egyptians can create a freer, more just, and equitable society, then Americans will see a safer and more stable Middle East. If, on the other hand, Egypt descends into political chaos and economic stagnation, then we'll be back to where we were before the Arab Spring, a region brimming with a hopeless, angry, and extremely youthful population with nothing to lose. Unless we want to continue to deal with that scenario for another decade or more, we must make Egypt's struggle for democracy our own. Egypt's military must relinquish power just as they said they would, and the country's fledgling democracy must respect the rights of all its people. Because you know what they say, as Egypt goes, so goes the Middle East.
Reza Aslan's most recent book is called No God But God. Take a second, drop us a line, letters@marketplace.org. Consider for just a second the urban bicyclist. Two wheels are increasingly popular as a mode of transportation in big cities, you know. But now consider the bike, increasingly popular as a thing to steal. Patrick Sims's bike was stolen, as was his next one, and the next one, and four more after that. So he decided to do something about it, and he told his tale in this month's Outside magazine. Patrick, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure.
This was, the only word that comes to mind is an epic saga. Seven bikes, New York, San Francisco, Portland, cross-country, police. It's crazy.
I was burning up with rage. I got my bike stolen. Then I got another bike stolen. And I just couldn't sleep at night. I was staying up late watching the surveillance footage of my bike being stolen because there's so many cameras in New York City. Finally, I thought I had stumbled on a solution, a way to catch every bike thief in America.
All right, well, go ahead, because there are a lot of bike thieves out there, as we learn in the course of this article. Tell us what you did.
We are entering the age of cheap GPS trackers, and they're getting tiny, they're getting cheap. So I started putting them under the seat of bicycles, effectively bait bicycles, and leaving them out. And what happens, the bike gets stolen. You can actually track it on the internet, assuming it doesn't short circuit in the rain, and, you know, the device doesn't fail. This happens sometimes. But in the end, I was able to deliberately get seven bicycles stolen around the country and track down the thieves sometimes.
The thing that struck me about this piece, the thing that I really learned was the degree to which bicycles are one of the main currencies out there in sort of an underground economy. And you have this great line. You've got cash, sex, drugs, and bicycles fueling this economy, only one of which is left outside locked up.
Yeah, we're a little careless with these bicycles, starting with me. You know, I'd put these sort of thin locks on them, and boom, you're just contributing to somebody's drug habit. Police told me 90% of the thieves they catch are drug addicts.
The thing that resonates to me about this story is that everybody's had a bike. Even if you don't ride now as an adult, you had a bike when you were a kid, you know, and you know that the feeling you get when you're on your bike and you're just going and you can do whatever you want and then somebody takes it.
It's an innocent, sweet feeling, and getting robbed of a bicycle is so personal and just burns people up. As I worked on this story, I was amazed over and over again. Everyone sort of went hugely out of their way to help me. They're like, what can I do to help catch bike thieves? It's just a very personal crime. It's one of the most common forms of valuable property crime now.
Tell me about your bike number six. This is the one, if I remember right, you bought it in San Francisco, right?
Yeah, the San Francisco police officers will routinely bust bike thieves, but there's a shameless open-air market
within a minute of arriving, I was being offered bicycles. I found a kid with a bike that was about the right size for me, a track bike, pretty fancy machine. I tried to bargain with him a little bit, and he said, you know, I looked it up. This is a $700 bicycle. So he wasn't even pretending to own the bike. So I got it for $125 cash, which the police in San Francisco told me was about $25 too much. I was never able to track down the owner of the bike, notably, because the serial number is not listed anywhere. I still have that bike sitting in my garage, and I wish I could find the owner.
Well, yeah, that's the thing that got to me. You actually do a shout-out in this magazine piece. You say, listen, if you lost this track or if it got stolen, call me with the serial number. We'll get it back to you.
It's a black IRO Mark V, people.
Patrick Sims, his article in Outside Magazine is called Who Pinched My Ride? Patrick, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
There's a link to that article on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on a Friday, ending where we started with President Obama. Last Thursday, he was in New York City for a fundraiser at the Apollo Theater. You might have heard about this. He sang a line from Al Green's 1972 hit, Let's Stay Together. I don't know how much money he raised, but he did fine by Al Green. Sales of the single were up almost 500% this week. That's according to Billboard magazine. And we're going to go out with a man.
I'm so in love with you.
I mean, come on, that was pretty good, right? Anyway, that's Marketplace from APM, that's American Public Media. Today, the Dow off 74 points, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up 11, 0.4%. The S&P 500 trimmed 2 points, 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, a visit to L.A.'s Chinatown for the Lunar New Year and envelopes full of cash.
You don't open it in front of them because it's considered like rude or disrespectful.
Xin nian kuai le, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.